It's Saturday today, and it's our last full day of session. So I've got a full, almost just over 24 hours left. So, you know, by this time the body and mind have really well and truly settled, and as far as they're going to settle. And so, as my old Dharma brother would say, get your money's worth. Don't hold back. Leave nothing on the field. So, you know, that means you're being meticulous in your practice. So, it's basic, basic awareness, and again, just letting go of that thought, making that commitment to let go of the story when we notice it. And sometimes that requires just getting your energy up. So it's almost like gathering that energy in, and then sometimes you can just focus your eyes and use that as a laser to wake yourself up, really bore into the carpet. Feel that life and that energy. All that takes is sometimes is a bit of a shift. Sometimes we think we're kind of in a certain way, we feel in a certain way, and we think that's how it is. But it doesn't take much. The way you're feeling, maybe because of the weather or something you ate, or who knows, we didn't get enough sleep. But our physical state can change just by the you using that power of concentration. And just shows, you know, things aren't as they seem. So, you know, in Zen, we've talked the last few days about that aspect of thusness, you know, and we emphasize always at least two or three main things, and one is that aspect of the absolute, which is the fact of our existence, the only fact there is in the universe. Alternative facts. There aren't any alternative facts. There's only one. And we can't even talk about it. And then there's the other aspect of we term that Buddha or oneness, and then the other aspect is the world of this and that, up and down, light and dark, past, present, and future, and that's the world we're pretty comfortable with, and we take for granted. And then there's the putting that together, which is sangha or interdependence. And those trinities are really common throughout all spiritual experience, and whatever, you know, it's most, again, is strong in the Christian tradition. The Father, Son, Holy Spirit are the three, that Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are the same cosmological way of describing that human experience. And so... But the aspect of think that tomorrow Jeremy will be receiving the precepts, and there's Zen especially has a very strong lineage tradition, so it's, and I think it probably comes from the Chinese. We don't have it so much in the West. We you know, it's not a big thing for us. We can tend to have very much an individualistic culture. That's I don't know when it developed, but it's so we're quite strong about cutting off our ties, and you know, ignoring our parents, and striking out on our own, and every person for themselves, and you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's probably the wrong illusion. But in the East Asian traditions, and then there's a very that lineage is a very important, and ancestors are very, very important, and whenever I come and do session, I kind of realise, you know, we're kind of got these robes, and Sinead's got one as well, and these things come from and the Buddha, and the candle, and the incense, and the, everything here comes from an East Asian tradition. And this morning, when we're reciting the names of the ancestors, I just realised before that the kind of little bit, there's a couple of missing between Kakurakuna, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, they're added in.
Okay, good.
One and one swapped.
Right.
You'll see.
Good.
Does that go up to, because, you know, there's no Mizumi or anyone like that in there, is it? Are they just all...
Oh, there is Mizumi. He's the last one.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, Bayan Hakuchin Daish, Hakuyu Taizan.
Oh, okay.
So that's his monk's name, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Taizan Mizumi. And then after that would be my teacher, then me, so that's because we're not dead. All those names go from the beginning of time. The first five or the first six are historical ancestors who tend to be a bit mythical, but they represent that the Dharma has always been around. That you know, there's no kind of ownership on this, and then through Shakyamuni all the way down to my teacher's teacher, Mizumi Roshi, and within that when you receive the precepts, you receive a lineage chart, and it's got all the names of all those ancestors are on this one red line that wiggles its way all the way down till finally gets to you, and then it goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha again. And it's a kind of a lovely, it's a stylized circle in a certain sense. It follows that stream, and it's a completely rotating orb, and yet within that, we were talking about bowing the other day, and we didn't come from nothing, and it's you know, when I bow and I bring my mind to it, you know, a lot of that's about gratitude and being able to be here, because this is no accident. It's a amazing accident, but it's also no accident that we're able to practice here today, you know, because of all those ancestors in the past. And so that when we do service and we chant, and especially when we chant the names of the ancestors, then we're honouring that lineage that has arrived us, allowed us to be here today. And so it's real. Kind of expression of gratitude for that, and the hope is that you know, this awakening will continue, you know, all down through for another 20,000 years or 2,500 years. You know, there's that I don't know that image of the net of Indra. Net of Indra it comes from the Hindu cosmology of, it's a vast net, like with all kinds, not just like a two-dimensional net, but a vast net that spreads throughout the universe, and every node of the net has a multifaceted jewel, and every jewel reflects all the other jewels. And that's a really nice illusion for our lives. And that reflection, where we are, it reflects absolutely everything that's in the universe. And also we reflect that, and others reflect us. You know, there's kind of no getting away from our joint responsibility. So I've been thinking about Dogen Zenji, and that, you know, he appears in the lineage chart as Ahei Dogen, is his monk's name. Ehe means great peace, and it also has another. It's the characters mean great peace, and that's what Eheiji is, where he founded the temple in the northeast coast of Japan, and so that's what Eheiji, the temple of Ehe, and abbots usually take one of their names as being the place, the name of the temple, and that came from the old Chinese tradition where the abbots would be called the name of the mountain, so they'd change. So Obaku or Linji lived on the mountain, and so that was their name, which is quite nice for us, right? They become the mountain, that becomes their name, totally identified with that. And also Dogen Zenjin, he started the Soto school in Japan, and also his name in Chinese, I think it's Xiaoping, Ehe is Xiaoping, it's probably not a great Chinese pronunciation, but that also relates to the time of one of the Chinese, I guess kind of a settlement, I suppose, but a Chinese emissary coming to Japan and bring culture. So there's also so that Ehe also has a ring to it of a past well-known Chinese Japanese transferring of culture. And so a little bit about Dogen Zenji. So he's most well known in the West as being both the founder of Soto Zen, and in our school here is intrinsically a Soto Zen school. But he's also wrote a vast document called Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, which is an incredible number of treatises and fascicles on Zen practice, monastic practice, and a lot of philosophical works and poems, and it's one of the really up there in terms of the Japanese literature. And so it was quite hidden for a long time, and then didn't really come out and hit the West until the 1920s or 30s, when some scholarship started to be done with Dogen Zenji's work, and since then it's really permeated the Japanese culture and our own Soto Zen culture. And it's incredible writing, from simple things like don't eat garlic when you're doing Zazen, because it's not good for your practice, and don't chant loudly when beside the monk's hall because other people might be doing Zazen. I think that even like Ruzhen says to his Dogen, don't eat wild rice when you're practicing Zazen. I don't know why, but all these kind of real mundane kind of things, through to fascicles on the nature of time and being, which are beautifully poetic and a real koans in themselves. And he was, he was writing these fascicles in various places, but a lot of them were written up in Eheiji, which was way up in the mountains, and the Ichizen province on the northeast coast, amid the heavy snows. So his journey, he started off, he was the illegitimate son of a very important courtier at the royal court in Japan, and his father died very young, I think he was about 3, and his mother died when he was about 8. And so he had and you think about that, it's kind of like, you kind of hear those stories, go, my mother died at 8. But actually think about that the challenge of being orphaned at a very young age. And then he went to, one of his uncles was a priest, and went to live with him, and then eventually got ordained into the, what was various Buddhist orders then. And then he went to study at Mount Hiei in the Tendai sect of Buddhism, which is And Mount Hiei, if you've been to Japan, it's just outside Kyoto, and it's a great mountain, and it was the place of it's got covered an incredible number of temples and monasteries, and it's a beautiful place. They had they were a good fortune to go up there. We were over there a couple of years ago, and it was kind of a misty day, and it was very atmospheric and monastery. You'd be wandering around the hills, and Jizo Bodhisattvas would appear out of the mist, and bells would be ringing, and pines would be dripping, and it's just a incredible experience. So he studied up the Tendai monasteries, and at the time the Tendai was quite a very strong sect in Japan, and there was they were more power from the government, but they had quite a bit of power, and they used to employ all these warrior monks who would regularly go around the countryside raising hell with other temples and occasional temple burnings, and there was even one stage when there was another uprising by a former emperor who employed all the warrior monks to go and fight in Kyoto, and this is all the while Dogen was practicing, so it doesn't quite gel with our images of peaceful Buddhists. As we've been told that Buddhism was never caused any wars. It's like, well, you just have to read a little bit back in history. And there's been quite a few. Anyway, so he was looking for the Dharma. His big question was because the, and our question too, is like, because the Buddhas have all said there that life is perfect and complete just as it is, why did they all practice? Why did they endure hardships and strive after realization when life, like it is just as it is? And so that was his question, and he met a monk called Myozen, who was Isai, who was a Rinzai Zen teacher in Japan, and Myozen, his successor, they made a plan to go to China, because China was where it was happening. But they were the Japanese kind of just considered themselves to be slightly barbarians, and the Chinese culture was the height of culture, so they decided to go to China to find out about the true practice. And sometimes at that point, it might have taken a year to find a boat that would actually go across to China. But eventually they did, and they went off, and it took them 2 months sailing. And as Dogen Zenji says, it's like trusting my ephemeral body to the billowing waves. Something like that, and then eventually ended up in Great Song, which is China. And when he got there, his first experience was he was on a boat, and hadn't been allowed off yet. That's right, they had to have travel permits and all this kind of thing. Very organised in Japan, they still are, but they had to get travel permits to be able to leave Japan, and to go into China, they needed to have their travel visas all stamped and that. So he couldn't get on the boat yet. Couldn't get off the boat until he had that sorted and got an official invitation from the local monastery. So. While he's waiting on the boat, he meets a Tenzo from the local monastery who comes on board, and he meets this Tenzo and further later on too. But the basic interaction with the Tenzo is that he questions the Tenzo why he's so busy. Taking care of the monastery and the food, shouldn't he be out back doing zazen? And the Tenzo basically laughs at him and rebukes him, and really just pointing him to the fact that as a young man he had these great aspirations, but that his life was directly in front of him, and that was what he was missing. And so. But you can feel it, Dogen's great heart of that he was full of vigour and energy to meet a true teacher and to really put his mind to rest. So eventually, after much study, he met a teacher called Ru Jing, who's just before Dogen Zenji. So he's And he, who's a part of the Sao Dong school, who's the Soto school in Japan, in China, and he puts his mind to rest with Ru Jing, and then comes back to China after about 6 years, I guess, over there. And as he said, I came back to Japan realizing that my eyes were horizontal and my nose was straight. That's what he got out of it. So, and then so, as I say, when he came back to Japan, it was again, he comes back and you realize all this kind of like, this is all the stuff that got us here today. It's like, you think about it, this is the incredible journeys across shark-infested oceans and then coming back, he ended up in Kyoto again, and now he's got this thing called Zen, right? And so he comes into Kyoto, and the Tendai school and the Shingon school and all the other schools are in full swing, and it's very political. And he's probably been a little bit of an upstart, I mean, his writing is he's always calling people, you know, those bald-headed idiots and things like that. So he probably wasn't too politic. So, and he makes a few enemies in Kyoto among the Tendai sect, and the Tendai sect didn't want any of these other religions moving in, other kind of forms of Buddhism moving in, because of their relationship with the court. Really, it was about a money thing and about financial support. So, you know, you don't want basically competitors moving in, and so there was quite a bit of a kerfuffle. So Dogen decided to move to a small town nearby. And eventually, that's the reason why he ended up on the northeast coast, up some valley in the mountains, because that was as far away as was going to be safe. And so,
did he get burned down or something?
I guess I saw the movie.
Yeah. And one of them got burned down just after he left.
Oh. Yeah. So it's like. These days we don't, well, in New Zealand we don't have that kind of thing, but that's the intensity of and the interpenetration of religion, of the church, you know, church and state, back then, to the extent that later on in the 1800s the state had finally had enough, and there were a number of persecutions of Buddhism over the time, earlier on as well. But you can kind of understand that thing of that real fight between the church and state. So, and that's where monks in our tradition were required to be married, because that was in Japan, and so that temples had to be handed down familial lines, rather than, and that was one way to break the power of the established Buddhist churches, if you could actually require the priest to marry, and then the temples would be owned individually rather than as a huge conglomerate of one organization. So he taught them, wrote the Shobo Genzo for many years, and it's interesting to note that you know, Dogen Zenji's this huge influence on us, but really the number of people he influenced during this lifetime is very small. He lived up a small valley in a would have been very rural back then, and so and he had a small number of monks and was preaching mainly just to monks. And so, but you know, his influence is just vast. Later on, he had a couple of generations down. He had another disciple called Keizan, who was really spread the teaching of Soto Zen, and he's also, you'll find his name in the lineage about four down as well. So, but I guess the thing is, like, we don't know the extent of our actions, you know, what they're going to cause. you know, it could be good, it could be bad. But if we set our minds in the right direction, you know, the benefit can be huge. And for me, it's kind of that thing of that about our practice is that we just keep putting ourselves into it. You know, we don't know what the results are. You know, whether we're going to see something immediate, whether it'll be generations away. You know, so there's that. And that's what I think about that gratitude is that all the ancestors have. You know, there are ones who died. You know, that we don't even know about, who didn't make it. And so in terms of our own practice, you know, it's that reflection. It's both. You know, for ourselves, but it's also that repayment of a debt that has been a long time coming. So then he died at the age of 53. I'm not quite sure what he died of, some kind of ailment, and at the home in Kyoto, his patron asked him to go and take some medicine and to. So he died there at quite a young age, and it's again, it's like when I was in Japan and coming off Mount Hiei, he was kind of wandering down the street and I see a sign that says Kinji Monastery. It's like this little temple, and I'm like, and Kinji is like, my God, that's where he lived before he went to Japan. When we came back from China, that's where he lived, that's where he met Isai. It's like one of those things that when you're just kind of bumping around Kyoto, you're kind of bumping, especially if you're a Zen person, you're bumping against all these kind of surprises and yes, that was a beautiful experience too. So all that, you know, that stream that comes all the way down when we recite the names of the ancestors, you know, that's and that beautiful imagery in the lineage chart of it going all the way back around to you is that responsibility and connection that we all share. And so I'd sort of just like to finish off that little history lesson with something from Dogen Zenji. So I think it's quite to place ourselves in a context. You know, it's the teaching of history that gives us a feeling for, you know, where we are today, and things didn't just suddenly arise, but actually they took a tremendous amount of input to get us here. So he wrote, this is a beautiful fascicle here, and I always, you know, really recommend reading Dogen Zenji. Sometimes some things are a little bit challenging, because he tends to use poetry and turning things on the head. So this is from the Genjo Koan. So this is part of what I read yesterday. So to carry yourself forward and experience the myriad things is delusion. That the myriad things come forth and experience themselves as awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. And when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. When you see forms or hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. But the Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. Firewood becomes ash, and it does not become firewood again. Yet, do not suppose that ash is future and firewood past. You should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future, and is independent of past and future. Ash abides in the phenomenal expression of ash, which fully includes future and past. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in the Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. And so these are the kind of things that we take up, you know, during our session and teaching from Dogen Zenji. You know, this birth and this death is an expression complete in this moment. You know, we think that, you know, things become things, but when we really pay attention, you know, we see that everything is complete just in this moment. Yeah, and so over the next all day, you know, we really practice that. Really practice that, everything being complete in this moment. So that again means noticing when we drift off. Noticing that we want things to be different. Feeling that energy of trying to create some other reality. And when we notice that, just to breathe in, breathe out, and come back to this direct experience just as it is. Right.